Hello everyone and welcome to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. And today I thought I'd do something a little bit different than I normally do. This is actually something that's been requested quite a bit in a few different ways, and that's talking about the history of Egyptology itself. So, Egyptology is simply the study of ancient Egypt. And it has quite a long and unique history depending on how you look at it. Now, it's nowhere near as long as, say, classics. So classics, the study of Greco-Roman civilization, has a much longer history in terms of being a what I would say is an academic discipline. You know, already in the Middle Ages, when individuals would start looking and excavating for pieces of classical sculpture, they would look for classical texts. They were sought after. They were copied in monasteries. So that's something that was much different than ancient Egypt. So part of that and part of our discussion then is why was it different? And then where are we at today and how did we get here? Depending on how this goes, this might actually turn into a multi-part podcast. So I'm going to try to give a brief overview today into when exactly we start Egyptology. But going forward, it's something where certainly I would like to do podcasts on individual Egyptologists like Flinders Petrie, who has a wonderful backstory, and really, I think, and of course I'm biased as an Egyptologist, can be seen as one of the fathers, if not the father, of modern, more scientific archaeology. But he's going to come much, much later on. So, where should we really start? Well, one of the places we can start, and it's maybe a bit pedantic, but I think it's a great place to start because it gives us an idea of exactly how long-lived and how ancient Egyptian culture was, is you'll often hear Egyptologists talk about Thutmose IV as the first pharaoh, who's actually we might call an Egyptologist. And this has to do with his particular interests. So Thutmose IV was a pharaoh in the 18th dynasty. He came after Amenhotep II, and he's ruling around 1400 before the Common Era. Now, one of the unique things about him, and something that we see kind of giving him this title of maybe the first archaeologist or the first Egyptologist, is he has a very famous stela that he commissioned called the Dream Stela. And according to this stela, the prince is young and he's out on a hunting trip, and he stops to rest under the head of the Sphinx. And as he's there, he falls into a sleep and he has a dream. And according to the stela, as he's dreaming in this place, all of the sudden says that I'm going to give you the kingship of the two lands. But look at my condition. I'm buried in sand. My limbs are ruined. All the sands of the desert are upon me. And I've been waiting for you to come and for you to restore me. And so Thutmose IV awakens and he goes about restoring the Sphinx. Now, one of the interesting things that we have to then interject here is he has this dream that he's going to be ruler, and he certainly is a prince, but he's actually not the crown prince. He has an older brother. And some people have looked at this and said, we can see the stela as a tool to reaffirm his reign and to legitimize him. But I think that that's a bit skeptical. And I don't think that we necessarily need to look at it solely as propaganda. Now, even though Thutmose IV only ruled for about a decade, he does appear to have actually restored the Sphinx. So he actually does build on a grand scale some newer things, but he also does restore the Sphinx. He digs it out, repaints it. And this is something that a lot of people have said, here we can see this brief little glimmer, this pharaoh who only rules for 10 years, but he's actually taking an interest in what we do now, excavation and restoration of monuments. So some people look at him and kind of will in a bit of a, you know, sly way say, well, this is the first kind of archaeologist we're dealing with. But he wasn't the only one that we had from ancient Egypt. In fact, one of the ones we have is an interesting pharaoh, Prince Khaemwasit, and he's one of the sons of Ramses II. Now, I've actually done a earlier podcast because he's a figure who we actually see taken over into popular literature because of his interest in the past. He's another one who we can maybe call the first Egyptologist, because not only does he go about restoring some historic buildings, tombs, and temples, but he also starts documenting them. Now, Ramses II was the most long-lived pharaoh that we know of. He is also known as Ramses the Great. He rules in the 19th dynasty, so not that far from Thutmose IV, who we just talked about. But he's actually somebody who had over 100 children. So it's not surprising that we have many sons. And Khaemwasit is one of these sons who actually is a crown prince for a time, but then he actually ends up dying. And his brother, Merenptah, who becomes crown prince after him, is actually the one who will succeed Ramses II to the throne. So, to give you an idea, we've got some different texts, and here's one text where Khaemwasit talks about the restoration of a statue of a prince from the son of King Khufu, who was the builder of the Great Pyramid. It is the chief directing artisans and sempriest, the king's son Khaemwasit, who was glad over this statue of the king's son Khawab, and who took it from where it was cast away for debris. In the text is kind of broken here, probably in the house or the temple or the tomb of his father, the king of the south and the north of Egypt, Khufu. Then the sempriest and king's son Khaemwasit decreed that it be given a place of favor of the gods in the company with the excellent blessed spirits at the head of the spirit chapel of Rosetau. So greatly did he love antiquity and the noble folk who were aforetime, along with the excellence of all that they had made so well and repeatedly. These things shall be for all life, stability, and prosperity enduring upon the earth. For the chief directing artisans and sempriest, the king's son Khaemwasit, after he has reestablished all the cult procedures of this temple, which has fallen into oblivion in the remembrance of men, he has dug out a pool before the noble sanctuary, in work agreeing with his wishes, while pure channels existed for purity to bring libations from the reservoir of Khephren, so that he may attain the status of given life. So here we can see Khaemwasit is actually restoring some of the ancient monuments, and he's then documenting them. And in this way, we could see something very similar to what we would see in a modern museum today when we're restoring an antiquity, that we have a brief explanation of where it was, where it was found. And this, I think, is great, and I love to show this part of the story of Egyptology when we're talking about it, because this is 1,000 years, or actually more than 1,000 years, after the pyramids were built. And yet it's still about 1,000 years or more before we're going to have Alexander coming in to Egypt. So with that amount of time, we can see that Egypt was ancient even for the Egyptians living there. Even in this era, the New Kingdom, when Egypt is at its height in the 18th and 19th dynasty, we have a period where there's already monuments that are falling apart. There's already statues that are in decay that are going back to 2500-2600 before the Common Era, and no doubt earlier than that. So it's fascinating that the Egyptians themselves were interested in the past and in the restoration of it, the way us modern Egyptologists are today. And we see that that especially then carries over, to fast forward in time a little bit, to the Greco-Roman period. So as we move forward in the Greco-Roman period, we have many, many who we might call actual historians, or at least fathers of history in some cases, like Herodotus, who are writing about Egypt, really from the standpoint of history. We see that within Egypt, we have priests like the famous Manetho, who's a priest under the reign of Ptolemy I and Ptolemy II. Ptolemy I was one of the generals of Alexander, and when Alexander dies young, Ptolemy takes over the rule of Egypt. He founds his own dynasty there. And Manetho is a priest of Re under him at Heliopolis, who sets about doing a masterwork collected history of Egypt. And the reason he does this, and the reason we actually rely on these Greek historians so much, is the Greeks much more had a sense of history as literature, of written history. The Egyptians didn't have that concept. The Egyptians much more seemed to have oral histories where information would be passed down. Their history was much more an idea of cycles that would kind of move, so that you'd have a cycle, say, for instance, the rising and setting of the sun. That embodies Re, who's born again every morning, who travels the sky only to die, to then go through the netherworld and be reborn. And that's a daily cycle. Well, the rule of each new king was a cycle. The rising and lowering of the Nile flood was a cycle. And the Egyptians would record historical events, and we do have these preserved on monuments of specific battles and specific monuments being erected, and for instance with Hatshepsut, certain trade expeditions. But they didn't have that same concept that we would see with, say, a Herodotus, who's going to sit down and actually write a history of ancient Egypt and describe the land. So that's something where when we do get the foreigners coming in, they are very interested in learning and trying to establish these type of histories. Now, those Greco-Roman historians actually had the benefit of being able to interact with an ancient Egypt that was still practicing many of the cultural legacies that we see today, or rather, that we study today, but that have not existed for hundreds and over almost 2,000 years. Because ancient Egyptians were eventually brought under the control of the Roman Empire. And as we know, the Roman Empire itself eventually becomes Christian. And we do see that within Egypt, we actually have the closing down of the pagan temples. So when we get into the 4th century AD, we actually have an end of those religious practices and cultural institutions. Now, many, of course, are going to persist. The Egyptian language still persisted as Coptic, which is a form of the Egyptian language, but written with Greek letters with a few additional ones so that they could actually have some sounds not represented in Greek. So it survives as a language. And then once we get to the 7th century, we have the Arab invasion, and then we have the Muslims coming in. Although the Copts are at least initially treated pretty well, they're only taxed at a higher rate. And then eventually we get some actual more tension, some rebellions lead to forced conversions by the sword. And eventually it gets to the state that it is today, where the Coptic Church is about estimated, I've seen it, about 10% of Egyptians belong to that church. And the Coptic language, very much like Latin in the Catholic Church, does exist as a liturgical language. But many people didn't realize that this was actually a continuation of the ancient Egyptian language. And we'll get to that more in a second. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. So as we go from the Greco-Roman period and the temples are closed down, what we start to see are numerous scholars who are interested in ancient Egypt. And these come from a variety of different angles. I wish that I really, you know, knew Arabic so that I could study some of the amazing travel logs and descriptions by Muslim scholars who are in the country in what would be the Middle Ages, as we think of them in the West, who actually are going through and making detailed descriptions of these monuments. We have many of these, and some scholars have actually today worked on reconstructing some of these travel logs and some of these descriptions, because we do see that some of those monuments simply don't exist today. Many people know that when you look at the pyramids at Giza today, we see that the facing stones are for the most part torn away. The Egyptians used a poorer quality limestone as the kind of core, but they'd use a very nice, more brightly shining Tura limestone to face the monuments, and it would be much more smooth. And you can still see that existing in some places. Well, those were hauled off fairly early on to help build the modern city of Cairo, and then eventually later even taken to be pulverized to be used in the creation of concrete. So we see that many of the monuments are being destroyed. And as we talked about at the beginning, many were destroyed and fell into disrepair in antiquity when the ancient Egyptians were still active. Similarly, we also actually have, in the Middle Ages, individuals from the West coming to visit Egypt. We have to think, when we think about the story of Jesus and with throughout the Old Testament, Egypt is appearing as a major role. So as individuals are going to Jerusalem, we also have to think about the fact that we have a flight into Egypt, that we actually have Joseph and Mary fleeing to Egypt after being visited by the Magi and being warned that King Herod is going to kill all the infants in the area. In addition to that, we have the Old Testament story of Joseph, where we have the actual story of the grain that was talked about by some American politicians more recently as the pyramids existing as these grain silos, because the story of Joseph in the Bible has to deal with preparing for famine and storing that grain. And of course, we have the Exodus. So in the Middle Ages, we see individuals making pilgrimages throughout the Middle East. And these would include and could include stops in Cairo and in those areas. And we do have churches and monasteries built up there, some beautiful ones. In fact, many people don't realize that it was actually Saint Anthony that began the kind of monastic tradition. And many of these monasteries themselves are actually built on top of ancient Egyptian temple sites. So there's a very interesting dichotomy there, where individuals are going to what's been a holy religious site for millennia, although the gods they're worshiping to have changed. So there's still this kind of constant interest in Egypt. But where it really, then I would say, picks up, especially in terms of the Western interest, is with Napoleon Bonaparte. So most of us have probably heard of Napoleon. So Napoleon, of course, very famously, right, we're dealing with the French Revolution. And Napoleon is, of course, one of our major figures. He's a military general who eventually becomes a political leader. And, of course, perhaps as happens when we're dealing with individuals who have so much power, they overreach, and eventually he himself takes on too much power for himself, he has himself coronated as emperor, and he's eventually removed from his position. Now, I don't want to go too much into the story of Napoleon, except as it applies to Egypt. So, of course, Napoleon is going through, he's conquering much of Europe, and he is active in Egypt. And when he's there, he's of course there trying to expand his power base, but he does something very, very interesting. And this is something that we see is very unique. Now, whether this is something that we would say is actually a aspect of his belief in the principles of the Enlightenment, so that Napoleon is actually very interested in scholarship and is very interested in knowledge, or if he simply wants to make that appearance, when he goes into Egypt, he takes with him a group of scientists, and we refer to these as the savants. So he takes with him an entire group of individuals who, as he's going through, as he's conquering, as he's fighting battles, who are documenting monuments, who are actually making detailed drawings of hieroglyphs. And of course, we can't read hieroglyphs at this point. The knowledge of hieroglyphs really dies with the closing down of the temples. And in fact, we have throughout the Middle Ages and in even late antiquity some texts by individuals from different regions who are talking about how they're actually able to read hieroglyphs, and it doesn't seem to be the case. So they're going through and they're documenting everything that they're finding. And it's really something that is quite brilliant. And eventually, it ends up with the publication of the Description de l'Égypte. So this is going on right around 1800, from about 1798 to about 1801. So in those 3 years, we have massive amounts of notes being taken, of works being done, and not just even on ancient Egypt, but on the flora and on the fauna of the region. So these are something where we really have a lot of knowledge being gained. Now, eventually, Napoleon loses. He's kind of forced out. And one of the things that I always love to point out that goes to show you just how invested in ancient Egypt, Western Europe, and Europe itself is becoming is the Rosetta Stone. The Rosetta Stone is what's used to help decipher hieroglyphs. It was found in 1799, and it has a decree which is really quite boring. There's nothing special about it. But it's written in three different scripts. It's written in Demotic. And Demotic is an extreme cursive form of hieroglyphs. Think about it as like a very sloppy form of cursive writing that most of us do. We also have ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs, and we have Greek. So immediately individuals looking at this know its significance, because we have these three languages, so they already knew this was going to be something that was going to enable them to hopefully help decipher hieroglyphs. So it's found by one of Napoleon's soldiers, Pierre-François Bouchard, and it actually is part of the war treaty. It actually becomes an object that the British take, and at some point there was actually, as they're negotiating the surrender, there's actually debate saying that they want to sink this, that they'd rather destroy it than let the British have some of their notes and these things. But eventually, they capitulate, and it's given to the British at Alexandria, and it goes on to the British Museum, where it stays today and is their most visited and seen object. Now, the study of the decree appears almost immediately. So, lithographs and plaster casts are made of this very early and spread throughout Egypt, or rather throughout Europe. But it takes a long time before they can actually fully get a sense of what's going on with the script. And there's a couple reasons why, and a couple reasons why it's problematic. So, one of the things that we see is that Egyptian as a writing system has pictograms, which are simply images that are meant to represent themselves. So a picture of a horse means a horse. That's a nice ideogram that we have. It's just a picture of a horse, it represents the idea of the horse, and we're done. But we also have phonograms. And phonograms are pictures that look just like that picture of a horse, but it's actually meant to represent a sound. And this is that famous Rebus principle that some of you may have seen, where you have a picture of an eyeball and we see that and we say eye. But we may not be reading that with the intention of meaning eye as in an eyeball, but eye as in a person. So we also have those type of signs. And then we have determinatives. We have signs that are simply meant to tell you, oh yes, what you're reading before you is actually a horse. So that image we have of a horse, we might have a little animal skin behind it, telling us that this is meant to represent an animal. Well, so this was something that they didn't know. They're still trying to figure out exactly what it is. And many scholars had made different advancements. One of them was Thomas Young, and he doesn't, I think, get enough credit. But by looking at some of the different phonetic characters used to spell out some of the names, he actually had injected this idea that there were phonetic characters used with inside. Because again, are we looking at something that's completely ideographic? We really didn't know. So we have multiple individuals looking at this, but of course, it's Champollion who eventually makes the decipherment. So he himself is actually a very interesting figure. He's somebody who, again, was a child prodigy. Thomas Young was one of these very, very smart individuals as well. He's somebody who knew multiple languages. He was a polymath. He was a physician. He was one of these really Renaissance men. Well, Jean-François Champollion was one of these individuals who was a child prodigy in philology and in languages. So initially, he's looking at Demotic. He himself speaks Coptic and Arabic fluently, and no doubt that helps. And so when we start to see this period of Egyptomania coming on with Napoleon's discoveries in Egypt and during the campaign there, we see that he starts to look at deciphering the language and the nature of the hieroglyphic script and the degree to which some of the signs were phonetic, some were ideographs, and then eventually, as we know, these kind of phonetic complements will come in there as well. So he's trying to decipher this language. And pretty soon after looking at this, he starts to overshadow the achievements of Thomas Young. He starts to push and go farther beyond what exactly it is that he found. And I think I'd like to do a podcast on sometime on the two of them and their kind of race to decipher it and how this looked. But what eventually happens is he has a breakthrough. So, although he was initially not sure what was going on, he does eventually, despite suffering from failing health and some kind of intrigues, he ends up being able to see that we do, in fact, have alphabetic signs, or these phonograms. So he's looking at that principle that Jung had looked at. He's pushing it farther, and he's making some corrections. And what he's doing is he's looking at the names of the rulers. So many individuals already knew that the names of individuals appeared in cartouches. So what he's trying to do is read these names by isolating what the sound values of the different signs could be, and then by comparing what we have in the Greek and then in the hieroglyphic versions. And this was a Ptolemaic text where we actually have the names of Ptolemy and Cleopatra. And he ends up being able to assign phonetic values for some signs. We're not looking at everything now, but he's able to give them to certain signs and say, here we actually do have these different grammatical signs, and they're representing these specific phonetic values. So as he's doing this, he then is able to check and see by comparing with some other monuments that we do in fact are able to kind of replicate his results. And so on September 27th, 1822, he publishes a letter on some of these initial findings, and this is the Lettre à M. Dacier. This is the secretary of the Paris Academy for the Inscriptions of the Belles Lettres, and he is presenting his finding there. And it just so happens that at this meeting, we have many different scholars. And again, this is something that everybody is really fascinated about. There's this Egyptomania that's going on. And they look at this and they see that he's right. And we see that individuals are then really now going forward with a tool, and then they're going to push forward their knowledge of hieroglyphs. They're going to keep expanding it. But I would say that this date is really when most would consider Egyptology as an academic modern field really emerging. 1822. From there, we're going to go on. And maybe next time, if we continue this as a series, we'll talk specifically about the decipherment of hieroglyphs, because it's very interesting. Champollion has failing health. There's also the rivalry that goes on between him and Thomas Young isn't over. And there's at points collaboration, but that devolves into bitterness and rivalry. So what we see is that at this point, we have really a competition in some ways exists even to this day in terms of a friendly rivalry between different schools of thought in Egyptology within France and within the United Kingdom. And it's quite interesting that you actually can look at the scholarship that quite often comes out of different countries and see that it does have a little bit different of a feel or of a focus. But that's something that's getting way too far ahead of myself. So there we have it, the birth of modern-day Egyptology. Going all the way back, I would say, we can look at some of those examples from 1400, like Thutmose IV, to Champollion and the eventual decipherment, or really setting the road to the decipherment of hieroglyphs. So next time, I think when we'll continue on, I do want to continue with this topic. We'll start to look at maybe some of the other pioneering figures in Egyptology that are quite interesting. One of the things we can talk about is some of the early archaeological excavations, and there's so many good stories there. People burning mummies, people excavating with dynamite, things that are completely abhorrent today that in many ways were the kind of rule of the day and the normal way of operating for many archaeological excavations. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt. I truly appreciate you taking the time to listen to the podcast. If you like the podcast, please subscribe to it and rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever format you listen to it on if they allow that. If you have any questions or any feedback you'd like answered on the podcast, please, you can feel free to get in contact with me on ericsguidetoancientegypt.com or also through our Facebook page, Eric's Guide to Ancient Egypt, or on Twitter at Eric's Egypt. I also have an audience survey on my Twitter and Facebook pages, so if you'd like to give me any suggestions or feedback there, please feel free, and thanks for listening.